And if you don't want to, if it's uncomfortable for you, don't. But if it's okay with you, why don't you go ahead and stand so that we can see you, and it's a little bit easier to hear you when we can see your lips.
I'm Kim Mattson. I'm from Carpenter. And I guess the question, TransCanada wants to put a pump station right near Carpenter on my land. And I was wondering, is the pressure by the pump station going to be greater right beside me on, or is it going to be, I was wondering if there's a problem there as far as pipes blowing easier closer to the pump station. I guess, I don't know who would know that, but.
That's on? Okay, great. My name is Brian Thomas. It's Thomas, and I'm with TransCanada. My responsibilities will be for the... is that loud enough? Okay, sorry. For the control center that will be located in Calgary, Alberta, in order to respond to your question, I'd just like to describe kind of how hydraulics work with respect to liquid pipelines. You are correct in your assumption that the pressure is higher at the discharge of pump stations. Keystone, as has been mentioned here, will operate at pressures of 1440 PSI, and that would be at the discharge of a pump station. The pipeline, however, is hydrostatically tested to 1.25 times that beforehand. So it is... has the same level of safety at the discharge as a pump station as it does all the way down to the next suction of the next downstream pump station.
Another question: How loud is this pump station? Is it quiet or is it?
I'll try and help with that. The pump stations are they're centrifugal pumps, and they will have 5,000, either 4,000 or 5,000 horsepower electrical drivers. In its initial configuration, the noise studies that have been done indicate that the decibel level would be about 45, and in the expansion case, Keystone has undertaken to mitigate any pump stations that would exceed a 55 decibel level. Now, to give you a bit of a feel for what 55 decibels would be, it would be something similar to a highway that was a half mile or thereabouts off your property at about that sort of a noise level.
Well, that don't really answer my question, but I don't know how loud that'll be, but can I ask one more and I'll quit? Now I understand this.
Sir, hold on. Let's make sure we get your second question answered. Do you want a kind of a comparison of what some of the decibel numbers might mean?
Is it going to be a hum noise? Like Carpenter is 3/8 of a mile away. There's 10, 12 people, maybe 15 people live there, but it's a town. And I was wondering, if you go outside at night, are you going to hear humming down the highway all night? I was just wondering if you...
Yeah, and it will, these pumps will run continuously, and so it will be, a constant, very, low-level background hum. And I
got one more question. Okay, another thing, too, the way I understand it, this oil in the line is going to be 68 degrees pretty much all the time. Is that right? It's got to be warm to move, I take it.
Well, and that isn't an important part of what makes it move. We've done studies with respect to the oil temperatures that you can expect, and it actually the oil warms up as it moves down the pipeline. So I just got to refer to my notes here. When we get to South Dakota, the oil temperature is expected to be between 60 and 70 degrees Fahrenheit at the 435 case, and then it will be between 70 and 80 degrees Fahrenheit at the 590,000 barrel a day case.
Okay, then, and so I don't know what it's going to be like. None of us do. I mean, you know, if it's 68 or 70 degrees in the wintertime, will this ground, is it deep enough so this ground will freeze like the rest of the ground? Or will it be, you be able to see across here while the snow is melting there?
No, and certainly it will continue to freeze, and there, it will continue to, you know, be snow there when that snow is on the adjacent lands. No. It will, like I'm sure you will notice, you know, late in the spring as the snow is actually melting, the right of way itself may be the first piece that you would notice not to have snow, but the adjacent lands would shortly thereafter, you know, have no snow either. So, I don't want to give you the impression that there's absolutely no impact, but at the same time, it is very minimal.
I was just concerned about insects that go dormant in the wintertime, you know, and you get a frost and you kill all, you know, an entomologist probably have to answer this. Would there be a hatch of some kind of insect staying in that field all winter because of this spot in this field that, you know, doesn't get as cold as the rest of it?
Yeah, my name is Scott Ellis, and I'm you know, directing some of the environmental studies. I think by and large, you know, most of the insects, you know, if it gets, you know, quite cold, and most of them are, you know, sort of right at the ground surface, and they're going to be, you know, however, you know, they're going to be pretty similar in how cold it is right at the surface where they are. I think that you could have, you know, just as Brian said, you know, a little bit more early emergence in some of those insects where the ground does warm up a little bit if they're sort of temperature sensitive. So I could see, you know, maybe extending your insect emergence season a little bit by, you know, by that extra warmth in the soil. But, again, I don't think the differences are going to be great or probably likely to change how you have to manage your field.
Yes, I'd like to know what your time frame is for the...
Excuse me, sir. Can I have your name, please?
My name's Jerry Rusher. I'm from Wasilla, Alaska. I used to live in Carthage, and I'm a little bit concerned about what might go on from what happened in Alaska. I'd like to know when the NEPA statement's going to be. What's the time frame for that?
Yes, the expected time frame for the draft EIS, which is the first publicly released environment portion of the environmental impact statement, is expected. We're thinking sometime in July. The final by the end of the year is the time frame. And just to clarify, it is issued by the Department of State. It is not us that prepares it or issues it. So these are somewhat, I'm estimating the time frames based on what we hear from them.
My name is Holly Beving, and I'm from Garden City, but we own land in the Carpenter area. I would just like you to define remediation of the land. What does that entail?
When we describe remediation in it is that once we have the pipe in and we've backfill it, some of the operations that will occur after that are relieving compaction, the heavy equipment that we take down, particularly what we call the working side of the right-of-way. We will rip the soil similarly to what I believe farmers do on a periodic basis to relieve compaction with paraplows or deep tilling type equipment. That is actually checked for comparative compaction levels to the right-of-way adjacent or land adjacent to our right-of-way by penetrometer tests to see that we've returned it to that level. actually that ripping would occur on can occur for subsoil, and then once the topsoil is put back on, is we will cultivate or disc or whatever to loosen that soil. Additionally to that, and it is rock picking that I talked about, is that we will, our specification of the requirement we put forward to contractors is to remove the rock to the size and density that it is less on our construction right away than appears on the adjacent lands to the right away. The other things that we do relative to erosion control, and this is based a lot upon a particular landowner's desires or requirements, we will seed the land with a winter rye or a seed cover if you allow it. If you do not allow it, we will not do that. Erosion control, if you have rolling terrain, we use what's called a slope breaker, where we might put some either with silt fence or some berms to prevent erosion in the case of heavy rains. I'm trying to think in my mind if there's any other particular aspects of we typically working with you if you want some, and it's on a case-by-case basis. Again, if there's fertilizer additives that you won't put back in, we can either compensate you to do that, or if you want us to do it, we can as well.
I guess my real question is, and please correct me if I have my facts wrong, when we were at a meeting before and we said if there would be a leak, how long would it take before they could shut off the pumps to stop the leak? And it was told to us 50 minutes. When you look at the 435,000 barrels a day, that would be 864,000 gallons approximately. When we get up to 590,000 barrels a day, that would be approximately 1 million gallons of oil that could possibly spill in a 50-minute period. My point is what's your remediation with that?
Okay, I'm going to pass this to another gentleman, okay. Please.
I get the easy one.
And please know, we're not trying to, we just want to know.
No, and I certainly respect that. I would as well. Just to talk about leak detection systems first off, because I'm not 100%. I heard the statistics that you mentioned there, but I'll just go through them here initially, and then we'll talk about the remediation side of it. Keystone will have, as Mr. Jones indicated, a computer-based computational model that will perform leak detection on the pipeline system. These systems are accurate, but basically the way they work is that the larger leaks can be detected quicker. So the smaller the leak, kind of the longer the time period is in order to detect it. So what we've established as our leak detection thresholds, and I'll just give you a couple of examples here, is that a 2% leak we would detect in 102 minutes. So that would be, at that level, 616 barrels. Now, when you get to a larger leak, just as an example, a 15% leak we would detect in 18 minutes. Now, I don't want to leave you with the idea that this system and others aren't capable of detecting leaks smaller than 2%, because they are. It's just it takes a longer period of time. So there's also other systems that we would use when you get to these thresholds that are less than 2%. Keystone will do a line patrol 26 times a year. There will be a line patrol. There's also, of course, maintenance folks in the area, landowners obviously in the area that sometimes would potentially notice a leak in the unlikely case there is one. So there certainly are other methods as well to detect these leaks that are smaller than the 2%.
But detecting the leak and stopping the leak are not the same thing.
Right, and now I'm going to come to the stopping part. In order to basically shut the pipeline down, the operator from the Calgary Control Center actually has to do two things. First of all, he would shut down all of the pump stations along the pipeline right away, and then once those pump stations have been shut down, they would close all the isolation valves. So all of those valves along the pipeline right away are remotely controlled. Now, it would take about 9 minutes for us to stop all the pump stations and to actually close all of the valves. And the valves themselves take about 3 minutes to close. So the pump stations take about 6 minutes and then 3 minutes to close the valves. Now, if that answers that part of the question, I'll turn it over to...
Are the valves in between each pump station?
Or
is there valves all along the way in between the pump stations?
Yeah. Just to give you an idea of that, there was 15 valves in South Dakota, and there are four pump stations. So depending on the line segment, there are, you know, a number of valves in between.
So when you shut off the oil between the two valves can leak out, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Unless the leak is between those two valves, but certainly if the leak isn't, that's correct.
I should just also note that please try to avoid interrupting one another. It's difficult for a court reporter when two people are speaking at once to try to get that all into the record. So just a request. Thanks.
Okay, and I'll just turn it over now to address the remediation piece of that.
My name is Heidi Tilquist. In response to the remediation issue, if a spill did occur, there's different ways of addressing that. Basically, once the spill occurred, Keystone would have to go in, do emergency cleanup, and then they would coordinate with state and federal agencies to determine what needed to be done. There's a whole bunch of different remediation methods, active methods, passive methods, things like using microbes. There are enhancements using fertilizers and oxygenation. And it's not my specialty, but there are quite a few. I guess the point to that, though, is those remediation efforts have to occur until that soil is brought down to a level that meets safety standards. So those levels would be so vegetation wouldn't have you wouldn't have vegetation effects. It'd be human health threshold levels. All the basically all the oil levels would have to be brought down below those thresholds, so it wouldn't cause any impacts.
How about loss of income then during that time?
I apologize. We were having a sidebar conversation over here. What was your specific question? Would you say it again for me, please?
Well, we talk about the remediation. If there's a spill, and we know that's a real remote chance. However, if there is a spill and we're busy fixing the land from the spill, what about compensation for when the land isn't producing as the spill is cleaned up?
TransCanada bears the responsibility, the burden to remediate and to take care of affected people who are, bearing the effects of a spill like that. We think that's part of our burden for coming through the property, and that's our deal. That's our problem, and we'll take care of it.
Thank you.
Say, if you would, Brian wants to clarify something that he told you, and I'll give him the microphone back.
Yeah, just for a moment to come back to that issue with respect to the volume of oil that would drain up in the event of a leak. When we talk about a pipeline segment where there's valves on either side, if a leak occurs again, in that segment, the valves are closed. I didn't want to leave you with the impression that all the oil in that segment drains at the leak site. Basically, due to the up and down nature of the topography, the amount of oil that actually drains is limited due to the up and down profile of the elevation. So there's only a fraction then of the oil between these two valves that would actually drain in the event of a leak.
Eric McPeak, Clark, South Dakota. What would happen if your leak detection systems failed?
We actually have redundant leak detection systems. The leak detection system itself, this computer-based model, actually runs on a totally dedicated system. So it's totally separate from all of the other systems that the control center operators utilize. And we have actually both, a main and a standby system, so that in the event the main system fails, we can swing automatically to the standby system that's updated with real-time data constantly. So we have a secondary system to go to immediately.
You know what would happen if that secondary system would fail too?
Well, it's, again, very, very unlikely that that would happen. But there are these other systems that I mentioned that, that we have in place as well that, that could be relied upon for that very brief period that, that is very, very unlikely to happen.
Okay, what would happen if the valves would fail to close?
If the valves were to fail to close, we would immediately send people that are located in close proximity to those valves to close them by hand.
Okay, thanks.
And just to come back to your question with respect to the, you know, or failure of the both leak detection systems, if we were in a position like that where, you know, there was virtually any chance of our ability to detect leaks and so on, we would, by caution, basically shut the pipeline system down until we could have those systems restored to their to full service.
Bonnie Durant from Carthage. Would you explain again what you said the, was it $6.5 million the first year, and then who gets what after that, or did you say counties or did you say state or what? I'm sorry, I missed that.
I'll try to go through taxes as quickly as I can. The project will pay sales and use tax and contractor's excise tax on the construction cost right up front, and that will go to the state. In some cases, it'll go to, like, the city of Yankton. When we come through that city, I expect to have to pay use tax there. But in a lot of cases, it's avoiding cities, so the 4% figure plus the 2% of contractor's excise tax, that's what we're coming at there. The pipeline will be centrally assessed as per state law. That means the value of the entire pipeline from one border to the other is assessed at the Department of Revenue and PIR, and they will fix the value by law every year on July 5th. They'll say this is what the entire pipeline is worth, and then as I understand it, they transmit that value out to the counties for application of the mill levies and assessment of taxes that get paid to the counties for the schools and county property taxes in due course. The pump stations, however, will be individually assessed by the counties in which they reside. So if your county or your school district has a pump station, you'd be looking at we think, annual property taxes in the maybe $600,000, no, back up, $200,000 range is what we're looking at, and the annual taxes based on a $10 million construction cost. That's a lot of thumbnail sketching there, but I think that's a general overview of how the taxes are going to be paid going forward.
Do the townships, you're going to be going over, under, rather, township roads. What are the townships going to get out of this?
The townships are assessing a small mill levy, if I'm correct. Do you know? And whatever that is would go to the township, but I think based on the way the assessor and the auditor's office are going to put that out. As far as crossing the township roads, we expect and will have to enter into agreements with all the townships for permits to cross through and underneath or cut the roads, as Buster was describing previously. And there's a specific provision in state law that allows the commission to assess a construction bond as part of this permitting process to pay for and ensure that that any costs of road and bridge damage are going to be paid for when we're done.
Thank you.
Don Huber, I have some land over here in northern side of the county, northwest corner. I guess I don't know if I'm online or not, but I've gotten books like everybody has from all these outfits. I hate to put a name on them, that are completely different from what you guys are saying. I have nothing against the pipeline. I just soon it went through. I think someday we're going to need it. But we get a lot of misinformation in these books. Like they put out, I think they said, on the money that's going to pass through the pipeline, it's put out like TransCanada owns the oil. And now you fellas here tonight say they don't own the oil. They just own the pipeline. Is that correct? So how do we sort this information out as to what's correct and what's incorrect? Because there's a lot of concerns that they think or whoever thinks that are addressed in this issue.
Thank you very much for the question. I agree with you. There is a lot of misinformation out there. And I think this forum is an excellent opportunity for you to ask questions with regards to what that information may be, and we certainly were prepared to answer that. So please, I encourage everyone, if they have some concerns or questions, I think the presentation did certainly a good foundation for understanding, but if you do have a specific concern, we certainly were prepared to answer any of your questions. And you're absolutely right. We don't own the oil. We are the trucker.
You know, this is Commissioner Johnson again, and I think it's worth noting that during the more formalized proceeding of this, the evidence that's introduced before the commission, that's going to be evidence that's going to be, there will be sworn affidavits. People will be providing testimony under oath. And that, if you lie under oath before the commission, that carries with it the same penalties, the same criminal penalties that it would if you lied in any other court of law in this state. You'd be guilty of perjury. And so we will really be making our decision based on the evidence, the facts. And when people make promises before the commission, those promises, if the commission were to approve the pipeline, there would be conditions based on many of those promises that would be made. Again, that's presuming the commission were to approve the pipeline. We don't know if that's the case yet. So hopefully that will give you some faith that it's not just you that's going to be struggling with what's truth and what's not, but it's also the job of the commission.
I'm Dale Wonhofer. I'm from Carpenter, South Dakota, and I guess I've got a lot of questions. I'll try to limit it. I understand that you do have a lot of landowners. I was wondering, how much money, what's the payroll to these landowners per year?
I'm struggling with this, Mike. You can never tell if it's on or off. There is not an annual payment to landowners. When TransCanada or any of its affiliates acquires a easement, we are acquiring the land to install the pipeline, and then the landowner continues to use the land after we've built the pipe to continue to do his farm activities or ranching activities as he has in the past.
I guess I feel that I cannot sign your easement because it takes away every right I've got. I don't have a right if you have an oil spill or if anything else happens on my land. I don't have a right to take TransCanada or whoever to court. And the payment that I get off this don't amount to nothing. It figures out, if you figure it out in 25 years, it's $500 a year. And that's really pretty cheap. Can't you do better than that?
So in the likely event of a spill, as you described, I want you all to understand that Keystone is responsible for the cleanup. And we are liable for any damages caused by that spill. And I also want you to appreciate that it's an extremely unlikely event. Also, once the pipeline is built, you'll continue to enjoy full use of the land. The fees, as Buster described, are based on fair market value. So the amount of money everyone gets certainly depends on how much land they own.
Well, it's so much to go through your land, and it's a very minimum fee.
Just a couple of other comments regarding it, because the land agents you're interfacing with do ultimately report to me in it. And I guess, as Robert had indicated, a fair market value payment of what you could sell the land for in fee today, but yet you get the return of the land for the use of farming or rangeland that's there, and it, we believe, is a very fair payment for the use of the land. Regarding the spill and the indemnity language or things in the easement agreement, what I wanted to express to the group here is we have gotten a lot of feedback from landowners such as yourself concerning the language and the complexity of the language in the agreement, and we have reevaluated that we are working towards an indemnity and liability language that is much less complex than the one that's in it. And our goal is to have that document available to our land agents here within the next week to 10 days. The comment I would make in it is we believe the full rights and responsibilities and liabilities of TransCanada is not substantively different in the new document we're going to give you. It is just much clearer and much less complex to interpret.
If I sign this easement, will I be able to take TransCanada to court if I do not agree with what they're willing to pay me for damages?
Is those types of things, if you're not in agreement and with a damage situation that may occur, you have the rights as if you were damaged in any other process, I guess, in my opinion. Now, there's a legal counsel here, but I'll get a legal interpretation, but if we cannot reach concurrence, you have use of the judicial system as any citizen does.
Not if I sign the easement. You have all the rights to it if I sign this easement, the way I read it.
I understand the easement language may not be clear in your ideas of interpretation, but our legal counsel has reinforced to me on several occasions, because I've asked in it as well, that indeed your full rights and ability to sue TransCanada over issues are there. I think the confusion, and I may need one of these legal counsel's help, is it's relative to the easement itself. And that language is relative to the ability of you to renege on that easement once you have executed it, that you cannot sue me over that. But as far as damages or other things, it's just a complex way that it's been written. Hopefully the newer version will be absolutely clear.
I guess I can't understand it quite that way, I guess.
And, sir, I respect that you can't either. It's a complex document.
And another question I've got. At this present time, I understand that you do not have a pipeline like this anywhere. Is that correct?
Hi. Mr. Jones,
yes,
Mr. Jones, if we could pause for just a moment. I don't know that we're getting good volume out of that mic, sir. If you could pass it to Ms. Van Bakkeren, I think.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Oh,
all
that's
right.
Much better.
Okay.
Good. Thanks.
I didn't know how to talk in it, I guess.
Well, that's all right. That's all right. Good. Mr. Jones, go ahead.
The question I have was, I understand that you do not own or operate a pipeline like this right now, and maybe never have, Keystone.
So thank you for the question. TransCanada has been in business since 1957, and we have owned a number of different pipelines, including liquid pipelines. We've owned liquid pipelines in Alberta, and we developed, designed, and constructed the Express Pipeline. The Express Pipeline was a pipeline very similar to Keystone. It moved crude oil, very similar to what crude oils were going to move on Keystone, and it moved it through Montana and Wyoming, and then from there we owned the Platte Pipeline. We bought that off of Marathon. Marathon Pipeline Company designed and constructed and operated that pipeline for years. We acquired it so that we could move the oil down Express onto Platte to the same Wood River refinery that Keystone is going. So these are some of the misrepresentations that are out there. So TransCanada has designed, owned, and operated very much similar pipelines to Keystone.
No. No, I don't believe you got my question. I was to a meeting in Aberdeen, And Nicole Atkins made the statement there that at this present time, Canada, the pipeline company, does not have a line like this anywhere. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. We sold that pipeline, and we sell pipelines all the time, and we acquire pipelines. And so, you know, it, as being a infrastructure company, a utility, there are times when you acquire lines and you sell lines. So we did that pipeline and we sold it, and now we're developing this one.
She told us at that meeting that there might have been two pipelines that was in a country far away that they owned at one time. Didn't say anything about owning any of these kind of pipelines lately. So what I'm trying to say is I don't believe you really know the effect that this pipeline could have on our land, on our water.
I respect your concern. I can definitively tell you that we do have experience of operating liquid pipelines. We've also operated them outside of North America as well. We owned and operated a pipeline in Colombia. It's called the Ocenza pipeline, and it went across the Andes, a far more harsh environment than we're going to see here in the Dakotas.
Nicole, would you like to explain what you said up there in Aberdeen at that meeting?
I would love to explain it. So what I said in Aberdeen is that TransCanada has 36,500 miles of existing pipeline infrastructure in North America. Those assets are in Canada, the United States, and in Mexico. We have previous pipeline operations experience in crude oil or liquid pipelines, which included Express and the Ocenza in Colombia. And thank you, Robert, for adding the additional crude oil pipelines that we operated, because I did fail to mention those.
No, I guess I've got more questions, but I guess I'll probably let them go.
I'd just like to make one comment. We're getting into a little bit of is it a fact, is it not a fact. There's one thing that people can always do, and they can always call the Public Utilities Commission. Our staff, we have staff and people who are assigned to this docket. They've been working very hard on this docket. The commissioners ourselves have to recluse from that, but we do have staff, and I'll give you the 800 number if you have a pen and pencil quick. It's 1-800-332-1782. And that's exactly what we'd like to hear from you. If you do have a question, we can help you work through our website too. There's a lot of information there.
Well, I'm sorry if I got you off track. I really didn't mean to, but these questions are very important to me because I'm a landowner. I'm not getting treated fair at all, and I want you to know that.
And, sir, I think your questions were good ones, and I don't think Commissioner Colbeck meant to insinuate that they weren't. I just think you wanted to make sure that people knew that this is going to be an ongoing process, and to the extent that anybody has questions about the process, we're here to help. So, thanks. Go ahead. Absolutely.
I guess I'd have one more on the easement. I was wondering if TransCanada would be willing to, after you get all the permits, I probably won't have it signed, this easement. I wondered if you'd be willing to sit down with my lawyer in my lawyer's office, and maybe we could rewrite the easement that I could live comfortable with. Would you be willing to do that? One more question you can answer at the same time. Did you have any landowners or property owners there when you made this easement?
I'm Sandra Roth, and I'm the U.S. land agent for TransCanada. Very close. Oh, okay. There's a trick, okay. In answer to your question about discussing the easement terms with your attorney, we would be glad to. The easements are a document that we will listen to all your concerns and questions about and go over with you line by line, word by word, with you or your attorneys. And we will listen to your concerns and try to get the document to be one that is comfortable for you in addition to serving the purpose that we need it for. We do understand there have been some concerns about the document. As Buster said, we're taking another look at it. Our attorneys are reviewing it along with all the comments that have come in from our land agents, from the owners they've spoken to. We do want to get this document to be one that you can agree to and readily sign. And so, yes, we would do that.
Okay, I have these two easements here. I'd like to have you take them back, if you would, please. I don't want them.
If you want to give them back, I'll be glad to take them.
My name is Tim Hofer. I'm from Carpenter. It's going over our family land south of Carpenter. And there's a few things I wanted to say. I'm just going to hit a couple. It'd be inconvenient enough if it goes straight up and down the field. It only bother a couple rounds, though, and they're going kitty corner across the land. So every round I make is going to be in the way. And if we have a wet year like this one, I'll probably get stuck 100 times. And I don't trust any of them guys to come pull me out, so I don't know how I'm going to get out. But the agents that come around are very inconsiderate. And I actually heard more on the news the last few days about the pipeline than was in our contract and anybody ever said, you know. Evidently putting a little pressure on them must be kind of helping to get along with us a little better. But I hope you guys take us into consideration, the guys that work on the land, just not just the money that South Dakota might or might not get. I'm not for the pipeline right now, so I guess that's all I have to say.
You made a couple of comments about one going diagonally across the land in it, and certainly as we move south, and I don't know the particular reasons for the I'd use the word catty corner where you use kitty corner, but there is some reason for that. I don't know that I know what it is tonight in it, but I would share with you that. One, when we go across that direction, as we cross your field in a diagonal, is impacts to you and damages to you relative to your farming operation during our construction and your tilling. You have damages that a farmer that we're going north and south does not have. We believe we will compensate you for those inconveniences. The second comment I would like to address in a actually had made a note from the previous question in the rear is that the trench line, we have two compaction issues when we build a pipeline. One of them I addressed is relieving compaction of where our heavy equipment runs. The other is returning compaction to the trench line and construction areas next to roads and highways. And we typically do that by when we bring our spoil materials back in with the wheels of what I call a maintainer or a road grader type equipment, or with the tracks of equipment to walk that down to get compaction in it. And where I would suggest to you over time is that using those techniques in agricultural areas, we generally do not see significant subsidence, nor do we have the issue that you've described relative to getting stuck in crossing the right-of-way. I would certainly, as you folks have experienced here in South Dakota this year, 10-inch rains and 5-inch rains and those things are certainly things that we have to deal with. But I would suggest to you my experience has been we can restore the trench line to where the issues relative to getting stuck or subsidence. I will not go on here to say when you build 1,080 miles of pipeline, you will have some subsidence that we might have to deal with, but as a rule, it is not prevalent.
You know, Ms. Van Buck, we've been at it for just short of 2 hours, and I wonder if we shouldn't give our court reporter a short break. Normally 10 minutes has been about enough, and so let's go ahead and we'll be back about 9 o'clock. Thanks. All right, ladies and gentlemen, round two. Oh, no. Well, maybe it could be. All right, ladies and gentlemen, if we could
Ms. Hofer's asked to start from the microphone up here, too. So
oh, yeah,
gonna...
absolutely. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I should mention that. If you prefer to step up to the set mic so you don't have to hold anything in your hands, by all means, just let Ms. Van Bakker know and step to the front of the room, and we'll put the mic up in the stand for you.
Well, that's, see, I didn't quite understand that the reason I'm doing, so I'm going to try to cut mine down here and then hand in some that, you know, I just had more so facts and things that I've learned.
Well,
so I'm going to change it a little here and have some questions and a few facts.
Well, and you know what? I actually did mention that at the beginning of the meeting, and thank you for reminding me of that. You know, at past hearings, not for this pipeline, but in the past, sometimes we have people come to these meetings and they want to read these articles or other information they've got into the record. And all, even though it just seems, oh, it's just a little two-page newspaper article, it takes a long time. We've had it happen before, and it really brings the meeting to a screeching halt, and everybody starts drifting off 30 seconds in anyway because somebody's just reading. So if you brought articles or information, we want them from you. We want them to be part of the record, but we'd ask that you come to the mic, you just tell us what you've got, describe it generally, give us the information. We will put it on the web. It'll be part of the official record, and frankly, it'll be a lot more useful in that format than it would be if you're just reading and the only people who are able to really hear it are here in the room as opposed to everybody in the whole world. So with that, yeah, I mean, if you want to, you know, briefly describe and sort of give an outline, and then if you've got information you want to hand to us afterwards, we'll get her in the record.
Okay.
Great.
My
Thanks.
Name is Pam Hofer, Carpenter, South Dakota, Beadle County. In this Keystone Pipeline Energy Conservation and Transmission Act that's been handed in under 22F. It says the pipeline is going to be 1440 pounds pressure. We've been hearing at some of the meetings we go into in Aberdeen, Buster had said it's going to go up to, what, 1800 pounds pressure at times. They're going to ship 435,000 barrels a day. It's going to go up to 591,000 barrels. And by 2015, they want to double it to 4 million barrels. So, there's a lot of difference in the figures there. And I'm going to skip that. I'm a little concerned with studying some of the spills TransCanada's had. They've had 576 spills in the past 6 years for an average of 96 spills in 1 year. So it's very scaring to us about the property damage, property values, the future of the farmers, and the results of the contamination to our soil. In 1979, in Bemidji, Minnesota, there was a spill that was never fully cleaned up, and 28 years later, which is now, the soil is still sterile. So this is very scary when you own the land that maybe something is going to happen to it. I'm concerned, too, with the depth of the pipe. We're saying 4 feet, but in my reading, it says that they really would only have to go 2 feet, but they're going to go a foot and a half deeper to be good to us. So is it 3.5 feet? Is it 4 feet? Are we really going to be 4 feet? You know, we go over with our big equipment, and we start sinking, and we're pretty close to those pipes if we get buried. So that's why my concern is about that. Let's skip that. I'm concerned, too, that it says there's only 20 people going to be taking care of this line. Are they going to work in ones, twos, or threes? This is going to cut their miles a lot for the way it's going to be cared for. That's something that I'm very concerned about. This is a real big thing to me. I just discovered this about 3 days ago, and I was gone today. I measured this out to make sure I was right before I came tonight. In the South Dakota PUC application permit, table 8, page 51, They say there's three structures within a 1 mile of the Carpenter pumping station. The town of Carpenter is within 1 mile of the station. I clocked it today. There's 49 buildings or dwellings. A child could count better than that if somebody went out to count it. So they must have different learning than we do to get that much difference. There's 12 houses. There's 5 businesses. There's 1 church. There's 25 structures, and there's 6 big fertilizer tanks. And the 3 buildings they have, the way I figure it, is across the road there's a old garage, and the park has outhouse and a lunch kitchen or a lunch building. That's it. And then one more thing, the Madsons have their lot there. I don't know what you call a structure. They have their lot where they chase their corral, where they chase their cattle in to work it. So that would make 50 structures within 1 mile. And if it would accidentally get into Spink County, that they can't get the Beetle County land, we're adding our grandpa's farm, which would be 16 buildings, and the neighbor across the street is 2 more buildings. Okay, and then I had the land buyers, but that's been touched, how we've been lied to, and that's been touched, so I'm not going to do it. Okay, I have one more here that's real major to me. This map, it's page 20 of, I guess I can't read, it's just saying what my land is, if it's farmland or hayland. My land, our land is right, this is a pumping station. We're a mile south. We angle through the quarter. This hazardous grass or hayland. Well, in a way, they're not totally wrong, because when the Indians came and our forefathers, it was hayland, pasture land. My husband and I now this year will be, we have owned it for 40 years, and we have farmed it. So that is a big thing. That's not true. In fact, the land is backwards on this thing. The map is wrong. So, okay. And I feel if they have to have the pipeline, they should go over to the interstate and go down there. If they go in the ditch or something, they're not ruining all the good farmland. We've worked hard for our farmland to put food on the table for our families and our children. And our land is important to us. And if there would be a leak or something, it would be spotted a lot quicker. And I think the governor calling him to tell him there's a leak would mean a lot more than a farmer calling him to tell him. So my feelings are, I don't like the project, and I'd like to see it stopped. Thank you.
Well, Ms. Hofer, I do have to compliment you. I know you were concerned about your time, but you did a great job at covering a lot of issues in a relatively short amount of time. So thank you for your consideration. I'm sure we'll be able to get to other people tonight as a result of that. So thanks. Now, I might just note, I meant to do this during the, and if TransCanada has some comments, we'd be happy to hear them. It's a little warm in here. Does anybody know the climate control in this room? I don't. And if you're familiar with that,
just turned down.
All right, great. Thanks. As usual, the room that I'm in is about 5 steps ahead of me. So thanks much. All right, Mr. Kennecke.
Thank you very much for all those questions, and there's a number of them, so we're going to pass the mic so that we make sure that the appropriate person, the expert, can answer your questions. One of your questions was regards to how much oil is going to be moving in the pipeline. And you were correct. The initial flow will be 435,000 barrels a day, and if you expand it by just adding more pump stations, it'll go to 591,000 barrels a day. Now, the number you heard with regards to by 2015, there'll be 4 million barrels, that will be the entire production that's forecasted for Canada. So that number would have been found by what they call the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. And every year they put out a forecast of what they think the production of oil. And recall at the beginning of my presentation, I said there was 175 billion barrels of oil up in Canada that they could develop. Well, they're forecasting by 2015 the ability to produce 4 million barrels, but that all depends whether or not it can actually find a market to serve the U.S. But this pipeline is 435,000 barrels, expandable to 591,000 barrels. I'm now going to ask Buster to answer a few more questions on the pressure and such.
Regarding the pressure and certainly record, yeah. And certainly recognizing the our meeting in Aberdeen is that 1440 is the maximum operating pressure of the pipeline. I believe at that meeting I talked in terms of test pressure, and the test pressure at 1.25 times 1440 equals 1800 psi, and I believe there might be some confusion relative to those numbers. Relative to the depth of cover of 4 feet, the construction mitigation and reclamation plan Mr. Koski referred to in his slides, it's a document that's been filed as an attachment to our permitting applications, and it becomes a mandate or standard by which we have to build this pipeline to. So literally by the issue of the permit and the permit requiring us meet the application things that we put forward, we are mandated by these permits to meet this 4 feet requirement. So relative to, we've had several landowners say, why is it not in the easement agreement? And we believe because it is attached and all the various construction mitigation requirements are attached to various permits we have, that bounds us by those permits and requirements versus it needing to be in an easement document. I was trying to see there were two or three other issues here.
I just want to clarify that question that Buster had on the pressure. That's a one-time hydro test pressure, and we fill the pipeline full of water, and then when we pressure it just that one time to make sure that there's no further defects, then from then on the pipeline can't exceed ever 1,440, and that's why we have the redundant computerized system to make sure that never happens.
And just to add to that, it's actually a PHMSA requirement that any excursions beyond that MAOP of 1440 are reported to the federal regulator, the PHMSA.
I'd like to clarify some of the spill information. I believe that this also I touched on in the meeting in Aberdeen for clarification. The 576 number, I believe, which was quoted, is an indication of a total incident reportable of all spills of any type for our entire operating system. If you go onto our TransCanada website and you look at our incident management system, there's three components that comprise that system. We have a crisis management program, an emergency management program, and an incident management program. Things such as lube oil leaks from any hoses of our bulldozer operations, that constitutes a spill. If we have any drops of liquid that come from any of our pumps or units, that constitutes a spill. So we have a very significant reporting requirement internally at TransCanada. So when you get those numbers, and if you'd like to check the definitions of those, that's also on our webpage, so you can check those.
I believe the other topic that was mentioned was Bemidji and the oil spill that occurred in 1979. This morning, I had some time between the hearings, and I took the opportunity to, Mr. Commissioner, to investigate some of the Bemidji information that's been put forward. And I would ask the commissioners for the record that I do believe that there's some misinformation that's been put forward to the commission and would like that just to be on the record relative to Bemidji. Relative to two particular items that has been raised in previous meetings, that I would like to address are is that when kind of a reference to it not cleaned up or whatever it is, I spoke to a Mr. Jeffrey DeLin, D-E-L-I-N, at 763-783-3231, who's the manager of that site at present. He has indicated to me that this site is a research and a study area that the federal government established for studying the migration of crude oil or like spills for study purposes. There has been no remediation done at that site for the study purposes of determining how oils or spills might move. The second comment was there's been statements that nothing will grow. Nothing will grow on the ground that's there. Mr. DeLin indicates that there is a certain amount of area that they have kept open for their study work, but that indeed it has revegetated in a lot of the area where the spill was, where there's trees, and even in the area that is kept clear, that there is grass, and I don't know the particular weeds we've heard about, but there is foliage growing on the site. Is there any, I'm sorry, were there any more?
Yes, with respect to possible inconsistencies in the application, certainly thank you for pointing those out. We'd like the opportunity to take a closer look at that information, and if necessary, we'll file an addendum to the application to correct anything.
How did the three structures come up? I mean, why wasn't that correct to 50 structures?
Just being here right now, it's difficult for me to determine how that happened. I'd have to go through the application. But if there is an error in the information that was filed, it would certainly be corrected.
And Pam, did you want to hand that in? That can we somehow make copies of that and make that? Because you wanted the rest of that to be on record, correct? Yes. Okay, and then while Ms. Van Bakkeren is maybe trying to copy that or another one, I have a... Oh, I'm sorry, Buster. Go ahead. Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
It was pointed out to me that the issue about a soft trench liner being stuck was raised again by Ms. Hofer. And again, I would like to reemphasize that when we dig and build a pipeline, and we dig the trench, we go to efforts to prevent the very circumstance that you've described with compaction methods of the trench line. And again, through my career over 30 years, and it is that an issue of this being prevalent in our industry, as I'm absolutely not aware of it. I will not say to you that it may not have happened on occasion, but it is not prevalent in the industry.
And, Buster, during the break, there's some people who, you know, as we found in other meetings, some people are a little shy to get up and ask a question. They asked if I would ask this. Could you please explain the difference between an easement and a construction agreement and what comes with both of those and what people can get out of both of those?
The people that have been approached about acquiring right-of-way, you've potentially seen two documents. One is our easement document, and the other is one we call a construction restriction binding agreement. And that is the document that is our preference, that there are unique things about your land that you want to capture to ensure that when we construct this pipeline, we adhere to those requirements. And if you've seen that form, it talks about topsoil stripping. It talks about access to the land. It is when we build a linear facility, we may cut you off from another field or pasture. If you designate you want a lane kept open for your farming or cattle operations, if you'll specify that on the form, we will facilitate that during construction. Some other things that may not be so explicit on the form, an example would be timber. If we're clearing some timber on your land and you want the wood kept for firewood or merchantable timber that you might sell, if you specify that to us, we will stack it along the right away at a location that you would designate. I will take you to a couple of other examples that I've experienced in my career. I don't know that they're here, but we've had instances where they are truly an elderly person or somebody with health care problems that might need emergency access for medical reasons. It's unpredictable, but a driveway to a home or an access to somewhere, if you specify that needs to be kept open at all times, then we will facilitate that. When we put that driveway crossing in, we will put a temporary bypass, much like the county does. But this construction restriction binding agreement is the true vehicle by which you can communicate to us things that are very unique and special about your property. If I think we had one today, grazing of cattle, issues about fencing off for cattle or in some instances, we've worked with landowners to move cattle to another pasture and as a damage. But these are the types of things that go into that form. And many landowners on the project so far have said, well, we want that in the easement document. And our comment to you is this is a binding contractual agreement between us and you guys. One, it's easier for us to account for, I'm sorry, I got it too far away. It's easier for us to keep up with it on that form than buried inside of an easement agreement. Secondly, Mr. Jones indicates 40,000 landowners. It truly is the company's preference not to have 40,000 different easements to have to administer over time. This gives us a vehicle to prevent that. So I hope that would explain the two forms and their uses, but various things that I've described are the places to where we can take care of that.
Go ahead. Yes, question in the back. Go ahead.
Yes, my name is Jerry Rusher again. The pig that you're going to send down through the line here in 3 years, is it a multiple pig?
If I understand your question correctly, you were asking if it is a multiple pig?
Right.
It is an inline inspection tool, a high-technology tool that can detect thinning of the wall. Before you send that tool down the line, during construction, we will have already sent down a caliper tool, so we would have determined whether or not the pipe had any ovalities and make sure that this tool can easily access through the pipeline. So I wouldn't call it a multiple tool. I'd call it a smart tool or an inline inspection tool.
So you're just going to inspect the line in 3 years?
Hi, I'm Mira Kothari. I'll actually go through and describe that process. The tool inspection run that we will be performing within 3 years, it's actually a three-part run. The first run is a cleaning run where we would send the first tool down the line to clean the pipeline. The second inspection run we would perform is that of a caliper tool nature, the one that was shown in the picture in the presentation. And the third run is the run that Robert just described with respect to the smart tool that would pick up any anomaly changes in the wall. So there'd be three components to the inline inspection run performed within 3 years.
Thank you very much.
Bonnie Durant again from Carthage. On this easement thing, can you run multiple lines in that given area of your easement? I mean, you're going to put in the 30-inch line now. If something came up in the future, can you run another one on in the same easement area?
That's correct. We're requesting that this easement, in the permanent easement, have the ability for a second line. Let me please explain that today there isn't enough production to warrant one, nor is there a sufficient market. So if that was ever to happen in the future, we would be filing again another set of regulations, and just like this one. The only difference is that when we came through the second time, when we were meeting with all the landowners, we would not only have the, I believe, Buster, you call it the construction space, because the easement itself is only 50 feet. The other 60 feet is a working, so we would pay, the damages for the crops, and we would also pay for the cost of that working spaces as well.
But nothing more the easement is, you can use my land, basically, right?
So the easement will have the ability to put in two lines. It'll be wide enough to put in two lines. The lines tend to be about 10 feet apart. So within that, you can safely build or construct two different lines. That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to add on behalf of staff, however, though, that the easement is a completely separate animal from what we're doing right now, and that this would happen all over again. The applicant would have to reapply for another siting application in the event there was a second pipeline.
Mark Nelson. We had our contract reviewed by a lawyer today, and he informed us that in case of a spillage, it would do a good job of covering the spills that happened on our land. However, if the spill would leak over to an adjacent quarter of land that was not covered by the easement, that in the contract it stated absolutely nothing. He informed us that in turn they would have to sue us, and we would have to sue you. So my question is, why didn't you put anything about the continuous spillage?
Yeah, I think we need to clarify the difference between an easement and TransCanada's responsibility in the event of a leak. In the event of the leak, no matter how it is caused, we are responsible to clean up the leak. There's no question about that. As for the easement and whether or not a property adjacent got damaged, we would clean it up and do the restoration over the entire spill area. The actual legalities, again, I'm not a lawyer, so I would ask Brett then to talk about your legalities. In fact, if you could do me a favor, could you repeat that question with regards to
if the spillage would occur on our land and if it would leak to another piece of somebody else's land, like a neighbor's?
And we would clean up. We would be responsible to clean up, whether it's on your land or your neighbor's land. There's no question about that.
And my second question is it a 100-year easement or not?
No, it's a perpetual easement because the life of the pipeline is the 175 billion barrels up in Alberta, potentially the reserves here. We plan to keep this pipeline in great shape. And we will expect the life of it to exceed 100 years.
I would just am referring to the lady that spoke about the large machinery. And I have some pictures that happened in our area.
Ma'am, I'm
this
sorry. Did you have an opportunity to state your name yet?
Betty Oliver.
Okay.
Betty Oliver. And I have some pictures, and the lady was referring to the large machinery have, and it took three tractors, one backhoe, to dig this tractor this spring to get it out. And I would like to bring these up and show them to you all because I think it's quite devastating.
Just so you all have an idea what's going on, we're just putting Ms. Oliver's name on the back of these pictures, and we will make these a part of the record. And if anybody wants to see them, they'll be available on the commission website.
When we go back on the record, TransCanada would like to respond to the equipment
okay, great.
Question.
Hartford.
Okay.
Humboldt or Hartford?
We are going to go ahead. We're going to go back on the record. And thank Ms. Oliver for her pictures, and the applicant has asked for an opportunity to respond. Go ahead.
Certainly the pictures that have been put forward here of farm equipment that is embedded up to the axles, that would be the description that I would give of it. Certainly I've seen farm equipment that has been stuck in the things in it. I still strongly suggest that this piece of equipment is as apt to get stuck anywhere in a field as it is our trench line if we compact it accordingly. All I can also answer to this is if you go to records in the pipeline industry that are filed with the federal government, let records of types of damages and leaks or things that might be caused by this are virtually non-existent. All right.
Sorry, I just understand that there was a follow-up question with respect to the comments around the inline inspection. The follow-up question, as I understood it, was if this inspection was only to occur one time. A subsequent inline inspection would be performed in accordance with 49 CFR 195. That rule states that pipeline would have to be inspected once every 5 years. So we'd establish our baseline inspection within 3 years, and then subsequent to that, within 5 years, we would perform a reinspection. However, as part of TransCanada's integrity management program, depending on the assessments that we would perform annually with respect to the pipeline, we would determine a frequency as such. So as part of regulations, we would look to do an inspection every 5 years. However, TransCanada would look to potentially perform inspections on a shorter interval if we deemed it necessary.
Hi, my name is Dustin Van Gilder. I'm owner of First Rate Fencing, a fencing company in the area here. With the Northern Border Pipeline, I know a lot of landowners had concerns about I understand that the fencing will be attached to the construction restriction binding agreement. What rights do the landowners have as far as fence specifications and as far as hiring contractors of their choice? And what will the pipeline do to, you say it's a 100-year pipeline, to maintain that fence for 100 years?
I think there's a couple of questions there, so let me answer the last one, because that's the one I think I understood, and then I'll have Buster to answer the first one. I would suggest to you that there's two kinds of fencing that you described. There would be fencing that may be required if during construction along the pipeline right away. And again, I'm going to get Buster to give you details on that. Once the pipeline is built, though, there certainly will not be any fencing along the right away. But there is a need for permanent fencing around the pump station. And the fencing around the pump station is a code requirement. And we need to make sure it's of a certain vintage as well. I believe the fence needs to be 6 feet, and it would obviously be able to ensure security of that pump station.
In regarding, I guess, existing fencing, and I assume that's where your question was, replacing of existing fencing?
Well, that, and I know the pastures that the Northern Border Pipeline went through, they built the fence, you know, with substandard materials, and, you know,
okay.
5 years later, they're, you know, it's rotting.
Now I understand the question. Is it that when we construct a pipeline, we need to have a continuous access along our right-of-way, much like when I say a road, and we take a section of your fence out, and we call it a gap, and put a temporary fencing in it so that our construction crews can pass through, much as I had described. Once that last construction crew's through, we go back and we put in a permanent fence and restore that. We typically use an H-brace and materials that I would say would meet the original or superior to the materials of the existing fence. But you're absolutely correct. If that's a concern from an experience on that particular project, the construction binding agreement, you're welcome to specify the materials that will be restored by. in that agreement, if that gives you comfort that that would ensure that we meet your requirements.
Would Buster, I'm sorry, would that gentleman be able to do the work?
Certainly in the restoration to it, if you desire to do that work yourself, and if that can be arranged as well using this construction bounding agreement, by which we will compensate you much like we would compensate a fence company to do it, or our own self. He is a fence company. I'm sorry.
Exactly like a fence company.
Okay. Well, I know that.
All right, aside from being the fence company, if you are a private landowner and still have an issue with Northern Border Pipeline restoration, whether it's fencing or anything else, please see me after the meeting. I also represent Northern Border Pipeline.
I also want to say, if you're a local contractor, I have been approached this evening with regards to that. On our website, you can register yourself and be included in that selection process.
Mr. Jones, do you have any idea on a percentage of how much local contractors you'd use as opposed to out of area?
Commissioner Johnson, that's a great question and a tough one to answer. We're going to hire, or we will select a general contractor, and the general contractor will then need to get specialized local contracts to do it. I'd venture to guess. I don't even know if I could, and maybe Buster, you could add to that. But we do know that there will be a need for local contractors like this gentleman, whether it be for seeding or fencing or other supplies. Also, we tend to use local contractors for foundation work, clearing of sites, for the pump station, the foundations, and the like.
I bet Dustin builds a mean fence. So.
I would say it is pipeline construction, and I'm speaking of that more than pump station construction, is a very specialized work that contractors that do large diameter pipeline construction are very specialty contractors that move all over the United States doing this particular type of work. Also, this work is done by union contractors in it to access the welders and the operators in it. So when we describe to it, employment opportunities are more through unions, and then when I say small suppliers and contractors, then indirect contracts because of the union contractors that are used to build pipeline construction. Again, in supplying aggregates, supplying various things, but in pure construction work, it would primarily be by a pipeline contractor with union labor.
My name is Raymond Feller. I live in Utah now, but I was born and raised about 25 miles north of here in Day County. My brother and I still own land, which has been in the family for many years. We got the copy of this contract, and neither one of us liked it. And we sent our, without saying why, we sent it to our attorney, who I think is well known in the state. And he agreed with all our points and added a couple more. So at this point, we're not necessarily against the pipeline, but we're certainly against that contract. And I do have a question. All of a sudden, we find out that there's supposedly a refinery going in the corner of the state by Hyperion Oil, who happens to be just going to use the amount of oil that you're going to be pumping. I would invite some comments. Thank you.
That's a great question. And for the first two hearings of this presentation, I made it perfectly clear, and today I skipped over it. And so thank you for the question, because it was missed in my presentation. During that slide, I had commercial underpinnings of the project. The pipeline is designed to move 435,000 barrels. And, yes, I'm told that this refinery is a similar size. But I have binding contracts for 20 years for 340,000 barrels to deliver crude oil to the refineries at Wood River, Illinois, and over to the refineries that source oil at Patoka. We are absolutely not connected with that refinery proposal whatsoever. And I just want to make sure that everybody really appreciates that that is nothing to do with Keystone.
Sir, I might...
I was just going to add that I believe my attorney's going to send a letter to TransCanada suggesting maybe some improvements in the contract. I did have occasion to talk a few days ago with a longtime family friend who lives in Calgary, has known the TransCanada people since their inception, and I couldn't find get a bad word from this person, for what it's worth.
Well, thank you very much for that. That's a very nice comment. Also, with regards to your letter from the lawyers, that's very good as well, and we look forward to seeing that.
And sir, I may just add to the refinery, that may take 15 years. I mean, before that refinery is even up and operational, it could take 15 years for all the permits to take place. So. We're kind of getting off the subject, so we need to focus.
It just seemed that it seems like it started about the same time you guys started, and it's very suspicious looking. You know, we all of a sudden find this out.
I agree. Their timing couldn't be worse.
Mr. Chairman, we do have a request from a gentleman that would like to make a presentation beyond the question answer format. Are we ready to move on to that, or do we have additional question-answer type format?
You know, I think we'll consider, to be considerate to those people here who might have shorter comments, to go ahead and anybody who's got comments like we've been having, relatively short questions or relatively short comments, let's do those, and then afterwards we can move to something longer. Yeah, go ahead, sir.
My name is Don Arn. The pipeline goes through some our land in okay. Everybody can hear me now. But anyway, Don Arn, I live in Carpenter, and the pipeline goes through some of our land. And I just want to have a little the opposite thing tonight, because I thought I was treated well by the pipeline company. And in anything there is risks. And if we want to do something, there's risk in anything we do. And I think this pipeline may be worth a little risk, and I was treated fairly. Thank you.
Are there other questions or comments?
You're talking about I'm Ron Opsel from Carpenter. You're talking about fair market value for this land that you're compensating us for. As you know, fair market value changes every year, just like your salaries and the taxes that the counties and the state is going to get out of this. Why are you paying us a one-shot deal instead of compensating us every year?
The reason we're paying a one-time deal, as you described, or a one-time payment, is we are acquiring the easement for perpetually. So we want to use it to get the pipeline built, and then we give you back the land to continue to use as you have before we showed up.
Yeah, but you'll be making money every year on that pipeline. Why shouldn't we get a little bit of the action?
Again, folks, we don't own the oil that's in the pipeline. We are the trucker, and so you know, we don't make any money on the oil that moves through the line. We charge a toll or like a postage stamp to do so, and like any utility, we make a, a reasonable economic return for installing it and taking the risk with regards to capital and such. But as for the oil that flows down the line, we do not make money on the oil that moves down the line.
Mr. Jones, I wonder if it might worth be noting as well that pipeline, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the transportation in a pipeline is a tariffed item. And so that it's not, a lot of people see the price of gas go up and down, and the price of gasoline really is driven by the market. That is not true in the traditional sense for pipeline. That is a rate, the tariff rate that's set by federal governments. At least I know that it is in the United States, and I presume it is in Canada as well.
That is correct, and we are regulated by the federal government, the FERC, with regards to tolls and tariffs. And so we do make a toll and a tariff for every barrel that's moved down. We charge, the analogy I would use would be like a postage stamp, like mailing a letter. So for every barrel that we move, we charge a postage stamp tariff to move that barrel.
My name is Kurt Hone. I'm the web manager from Aberdeen, South Dakota. Mr. Jones, you've made that statement at every meeting we've attended, the fact that you're the trucker and you really don't own the oil. But isn't it true in your own website and in news stories on the Internet that one of the biggest investors in TransCanada Pipeline is Phillips Petroleum and Conoco, and they also own the oil? You make it sound like you're just some poor trucker schlepping this oil across the state when really the people that own you are the people that own the oil. Now, maybe what you'd like to do, you always say we don't put out, I'm not putting out accurate information. I'm getting it off your website. Maybe what you'd like to do tomorrow is issue to the press a listing of everybody that's invested in your company, who owns the shares, so we can find out who owns TransCanada Pipeline and who owns the oil that's going to be shipped in it. You're not a trucker. The people that own you own the oil, and they could be paying these farmers an annual payment based on the price of oil. So when the oil price went up, they shared in the wealth, and when it went down, they shared in the reduction. You're not a trucker, sir. You're a pipe company owned by oil companies, by Texas oil companies. So would you like to answer that question?
So we look forward to answering that question and for folks to really recognize the falsehood of these statements. TransCanada is absolutely not owned by the Texas oil companies. TransCanada is traded on two stock exchanges. It's traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange and it's traded on the New York Stock Exchange. We are a publicly traded utility, like any other utility that crosses the state. So we are absolutely not owned by an oil company.
So, just so we're clear here, anybody in this room can buy a share in your company.
That's absolutely correct. And, in fact, I encourage you to buy shares in TransCanada.
Except anyone in this room except for the three commissioners.
Yeah, the shareholder names is TRP, and we certainly do encourage you to have a look at it.
My name is Mike Nelson, and I was wondering, you put a tax on each gallon of oil, but on this easement you say one or more pipelines. Well, we would like to get paid for one or more pipelines if you're going to do that. You know, I only want one, and I really don't want that, but if you got an easement for one or more, shouldn't we expect to get paid for one or more?
I think there's some confusion in what the legal definition may be of what an easement is. And just to answer on behalf of commission staff, please help me, Mr. Kennecke, maybe define what an easement is, but it's a sale for the use of land. Is that correct? It's the fair market value for the use of that land.
it's a grant of an interest in real property that's not, doesn't rise to the level of a sale of the entirety of the property, but it's a grant of an interest, in this case a subsurface interest, to have a utility residing in that ground and passing through it. Does that square, Ms. Van Bakkern, with your understanding?
Then why, when we get these contracts, it says right in there, if we're going to pay you for the easement, you're saying these are two separate things. So then why is it in this contract? We're going to pay you for the easement, and then we're going to pay you for the, or we're going to, you know, reimburse you for the stuff that, obviously for the crop. So why is this two separate things, but we're going to receive one check for the compensation, or, you know, the easement money and the...
Excuse me, can I have your name, please? Thank you.
You know, we actually had two individuals back there. The first individual, why don't you say your name again? The first one, go ahead and say. Mark Nelson. Mike Nelson. Okay. And the second one was Mark Nelson. There we go. Good. Thanks very much.
Okay. I think I understood the question, and if my answer is not responsive, I'd ask it, you ask it again. But in making our payments, we separate the payments into two things, the acquisition of the easement and the payment for damages. And that's the process that we go through in making those payments. What I did not understand in the question was about the separation in the easement document or something.
So if you put another pipeline in, are
Excuse
we going to get paid again?
Excuse me. I'm sorry. I can't see in the back of the room. So
Mark Nelson. So are we going to get paid again for the second pipeline to come through?
For the easement that we're paying the fair market value for, you would not get a compensation for that. You would get a compensation for the damage portion that we've talked about before, much like in this time. We would have to have the temporary workspace to construct the second line, and you would be compensated for that. I'm sorry, I got people speaking to me. I said the workspace and the damages, I think. Okay.
Okay, my name is Mike Nelson again, and we had some land that I'll just use some round figures, but we'll say I was offered like $1,000 an acre, and I had a land sold like a mile away that was sold for like $1,500 an acre. So how is that like a fair easement? I mean, when they told me, they said, well, land's here sells for $1,000. But yet a mile and a half away, it sold for $1,500.
In the process of determining what we were going to offer, well, let me back up first. There are two ways historically to pay for an easement. One is to offer the full fair market value of the property, and the second is to offer for the easement value of the property, which is a greatly reduced percentage of what the full market value is, and that is done in some regions. TransCanada decided on the Keystone Project, we would offer you full fair market value for the easement. Now, in the beginning of our process, we had independent appraisers from the area go out and do market studies to determine the different values of the properties. If you find that the market value we're offering today is not what you think it should be, we will sit down and talk with you. And if you can show us evidence to the contrary, that your land should be valued at a higher value than what we've offered you, we will talk to you about that. It is a negotiable dollar value.
This is really out of my area of expertise, and it's not something the Public Utilities Commission under state law is given any authority over. But, you know, TransCanada doesn't need to respond, but I just might offer a suggestion. It seems as though some people are concerned about that second pipeline, and I just wonder if you could research what other companies have done, in North America. Have there been easements that have been written that allow for a second payment if a second pipeline were to go in, or a third payment if there were a third pipeline to go in? And if you haven't had an opportunity to research that, maybe that might be a mechanism that would gain greater landowner comfort with the easement document. Thanks.
We'd have to do the research, Commissioner.
Floyd Hansmeyer, Bristol, South Dakota. It was kind of brought up, but maybe I missed it. Who owns the oil?
It's going past Day County, Valley Township, where we have property. Who owns the oil? Is it the country of Canada, an oil company up there, or the oil company in Oklahoma or Illinois?
Commissioner, we should just leave this mic on, and I'll try and take care to do that. Thank you very much for the question. It's a good question. When we go out to solicit for these binding contracts, the entity that owns the oil is called a shipper, and the shippers out there can be a variety of companies. They could potentially be Canadian oil producers, and in the U.S. they could be U.S. refiners. There's also marketing companies. These are just companies that buy and sell oil. And so there's a variety of different entities that can own the oil in the pipeline. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. Do these people bear any responsibility in case of a spill?
No, they don't. TransCanada bears responsibility to clean up the spill.
What about national security issues, both state and national?
That is a very good question, and we have to be conscious of Homeland Security requirements, and that actually comes to the fact that we have to put a fence, for example, for security over the pump station. Also, we cannot put the exact legal land description of where the pipeline is on the Internet or have maps that can be distributed amongst the public or ship, for example, overseas. And so we have to be very conscious to make sure that that we follow the guidelines of Homeland Security.
One comment, I know it's some folks have said that they haven't been treated right with the easement people's come out. I know I have two neighbors that are working for the company, and I know very well that they, certainly those two individuals are not folks that would do anything to coerce or to talk somebody into it if they didn't want to or whatever. And if they're hiring people like them, I just can't believe that there'd be any problems.
This is Raymond Feller again. One question. What compensation do you offer for the pumping station locations if it's different from...
We are offering a different compensation plan for acquisition of the pump stations. The reason being that will be a fee purchase and we will own the property in its entirety. And right now the pump station offers are being prepared to go out. Maybe some of you have been talked to about it already. Frankly, because that is a fee purchase between the landowner and Keystone, we would like to keep those negotiations at a private level. We don't feel that it should be a public thing on what someone is selling their land for, that most of the landowners who are selling to us prefer to keep that private. But it is a different plan than what we use to compensate for the easement.
Thank you. It's my understanding that there's a possibility it was going on a cousin of mine land, perhaps, and I'm just interested in her gaff. She couldn't be here. Thank you.
You want to know whether or not your cousin's going to have to buy you the next round when you guys get together, right?
Is it on?
Can you state your name again?
Kim Mattson, Carpenter. I'd like to know, down the line, you know, things happen in life. I don't know if TransCanada or Keystone or whoever, if something happens and you're not here, and you know, the business goes broke or whatever, I was wondering, is there going to be any bonds or anything to take care of things if things go haywire and we got all this stuff in the ground and things rust out? And I guess I was wondering about that. I take it, are you a limited liability company, or I mean,
I think the answer to your question is regards to regulation. As a utility, we have to comply with regulation. So for the life of the pipeline, and it's for the benefit of the owner and the operator of the pipeline, you want to continue to maintain it so it is in just as good a shape, let's say 100 years from now, as it is today. And so we have codes and regulations where you need to continue to maintain it. And even if you look at examples where I know we heard about pipeline companies that went bankrupt in the past, and Enron continues to be one of the names that is brought up, but even during all those bankruptcies, the pipelines they owned continued to be operated, the tolls continued to be paid, and they continued to maintain them. And that's because that's the law, that's the code, and they need to continue to do so.
We've got a question in the back there and another one here. Maybe let's take another question and then we'll take another short break, because I see we've got a few questions and might as well get one a break right now. So go ahead.
Bonnie Durant here. Did you say what you are bonded? I know you said you had to keep the pipelines going, but is the company have a bond? What happens if the pipeline would go belly up? Who's responsible? I mean, the counties that they're going through, I know Minor County can't afford to clean up a mess if something happens.
So I understand your question. That has to do with what happens if, for example, TransCanada went bankrupt. And I think the answer would be very similar to what happened with Enron. It would go into bankruptcy proceedings, but you would need to continue. In fact, the new owner would want you to continue to operate the pipeline safely, and as I suggested before, they have to. That's the law, and that's under the code requirements, and that's because you'd want to continue to have the revenue stream. And so the bankruptcy proceedings, and TransCanada was part of that. How we acquired Northern Border was, you know, a company went bankrupt, and we were the new owners, and we ended up acquiring that asset. And so there'd be a transaction. And you would, you know, go through the bankruptcy proceedings. They continue to do the operation to make sure that the pipeline was operated safely, and the tolls or tariffs would continue to be paid and collected.
But still, there is no bond issued. I mean, that you don't have different entities have to have a bond if something. I mean, basically, it's just like if you're charged with a crime, if you're let out on bail, you have to pay a bail bond. All right, you've got a bond. You don't have, other than you're guaranteeing that the oil keeps coming through the pipeline. That's what I'm getting at. Is there $100,000 or $100 billion saying somewhere in a bond that says hell or high water? This is here. Everybody is going to be taken care of.
To answer your question with regards to bonds, there will be a bond that will need to be posted for during construction for any potential damage, like crossing bridges and roads. But we do not have a bond during operations to have anything once the pipeline is in service. No.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's go ahead and take a relatively short break, and we'll come back and get some other questions and comments. So let's go ahead and take those couple of short comments, and then we can go to this gentleman's presentation. All right. Well, if nobody's, let's go ahead and sir, you had indicated to Ms. Van Bakkeren you wanted to make a brief presentation, something longer than Q&A. And actually, Commissioner Kolbeck does have a question, so we'll take him, and then we'll go right to you, sir.
And mine's a very short question. Mine was asked out in the hall of someone who didn't want to come up. Is there ever a time when there's a leak that you consider to be a non, substantial enough leak to shut down the pipeline? And if so, how long does it take you to fix that? In other words, is there ever an occurrence where it's not leaking very bad, so we'll just send somebody out there to fix it while there's oil flowing through it? Or does any leak stop operation of the pipeline, and then you go find it and fix it?
Thank you for that question, Commissioner. The answer is if there is ever identification of a leak, and even if we haven't confirmed it, somebody phones us up and they say, I saw black liquid sitting over the tight pipeline, we automatically shut down the line.
I'm sorry. There's nothing is considered too small to shut down the pipeline.
No, certainly not. Keystone's policy is certainly that no leaks are acceptable. We will err on the side of safety most definitely. In fact, operation of the pipeline will be shut down if there's a suspected leak immediately as well. So absolutely under all cases, even suspected leaks is an automatic line shutdown.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission, my name is George Piper. I reside at 818 9th Street Southwest here in South Dakota. I'm a member of the Board of Directors for the South Dakota Resources Coalition, and we have applied for party status in this matter, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Coalition. The Coalition was organized as a nonprofit organization about 35 years ago, and we advocate in the public interest on natural resource environmental matters. We have we're an all-volunteer board. We have no vested interest in property affected by the pipeline or in the investments of TransCanada. First of all, we're concerned that the Raptor report of February 2007 is being withheld from the public. Notwithstanding the federal regulations that protect the bald eagle and habitat, there is public interest in the preservation of the eagles as a species. And we believe that the public has a right to know what the impacts of this project will be on the species and the habitat. I have been informed by personnel of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that it was the decision of the of TransCanada and their consultants not to divulge this. It was not a decision of the regulatory agency to maintain this information as confidential. I believe that the Raptor report should be released for public inspection during these proceedings. Now, crude oil pipelines leak. TransCanada's spill frequency volume study projects that a spill of between 50 and 1,000 barrels of crude oil anywhere along the pipeline may occur once in 12 years. The study also indicates that large spills may occur, larger spills. My information is all taken from documents that we have reviewed that have been issued by TransCanada on the pipeline that were provided with their application to the State Department. So these are all facts from their documents. I have a couple of picture here. Now the picture indicates there that the route of the TransCanada pipeline lies along the eastern slope of the James River drainage almost entirely throughout the state. The particular picture in front of you shows probably just the northern portion of this area. This area has, it contains some of the richest wetlands, as well as several aquifers that are used for domestic water use. Some of the surface water bodies in the vicinity of the proposed pipeline route include the Fordham Reservoir near Clark in Clark County, Foster Creek in Clark and Spink County, Crow Creek and Crow Creek Drainage Ditch in Marshall County, Rensenhausen Slough in Marshall County, Amsden Lake in Day County, and tributaries along Logan Dam and Reservoir in Clark County and Antelope Creek in Day County. All of these, all the drainage from surface waters throughout this region drains into the James River. Also, there are numerous ground aquifers in the area of the vicinity of the proposed route. And these have been identified by TransCanada. Some of the aquifers are of shallow depth, that is, at a low distance between the ground surface. The Oaks Aquifer in Marshall County area with a depth of 10 to 15 feet below the surface, and the upper layers of the Altamont Aquifer near Raymond in Clark County varies from 10 to 35 feet below surface. Now, crude oil contains several very toxic chemicals. Some of the lighter weight chemicals like benzene, toluene, ethylene, benzene, and xylene can rapidly disperse.
Can you say the chemicals again, please?
Yeah, it was benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene. And these chemicals are some of the lighter weight chemicals in petroleum products, and they can rapidly disperse in water or wet soils. These are all regulated contaminants in both surface and groundwater by the U.S. EPA and South Dakota water quality standards. For example, the enforceable standard for benzene is 0.005 parts per million. That's an enforceable standard. Again, pipelines leak. Now, to us, TransCanada has not proven that a crude oil spill in or around any of these surface waters or a spill in the area of the shallow aquifers would not pollute the water in violation of the water quality standards. Our recommendations to the commission regarding protections for the environment as well as soil and natural resources, we think that the commission should require TransCanada to provide a remedial plan that they and their contractors will follow to clean up soil, surface waters, and groundwaters contaminated by an operational crude oil spill, both inside and outside of the right-of-way, easement right-of-way. The plan should also include reimbursement to landowners, adjacent property owners, water utilities, and public lands and resources that are impacted by an oil spill or pipeline accidents. Also, we feel that the TransCanada should be required, along with its partners, to post bond and a cash payment with State of South Dakota to cover the cost of cleanup of any crude oil spill during the lifetime of the project. You know, we repeatedly hear that, yes, we will clean up everything. We will take care of everything. But where is that in writing? Where is that? Where is all this commitment to take care of everything in writing and documented and on file with public entities, both at the state level and throughout the state, regarding their commitment to take care of things? Now, we're told that we need this crude oil pipeline that will contribute to meet our energy needs and solve the energy problems. Well, they tell us, the petroleum industry tells us that, and of course we increase using petroleum all the time. However, I would encourage the commission to generate some leadership in the state in developing an energy policy that's going to move us away from the use of fossil fuel and the burning of carbon products, which contribute to carbon emissions and global warming. Now, the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission has done a lot in advancing things like wind power and other alternatives that are more environmental friendly than the use of fossil fuels. I know this is a big issue, but there is an emergency emerging national policy that we really take account of the carbon emissions, and that there will be a policy emerging that stresses conservation and more efficient use. Even at this time, Congress, although very limited, are advancing fuel efficiency standards for cars and trucks. And we would encourage the commission to, you know, get on board on some of these things. I think that some of those things would be they can offer a lot of, there's a lot of jobs involved in developing other energy types of things. That's the end of my remarks, but throughout the discussion this evening, I guess when one sits around, you think of a lot of questions. And the statement was made, this is a little bit different, and I can direct a couple questions over here now. The statement was made that for the in this regards the taxing of the pipeline, that the first year it is taxed on a value. Is it taxed on that value every year, or does the value change?
State law provides that the pipeline will be valued each and every year. Could it be the same from year to year? Yes, it could, if the value, as the State Department of Revenue has set forth, the mechanism that they use to set the value results in the same. That's a possibility. Could it be different? That's also a possibility. But it will be revalued every year. It will be revisited every year on July 5th, according to state law. The pipeline has to be valued.
Have you had any communications with the Revenue Department about the assessment of the pipeline, the values in the assessment of the pipeline?
I have not.
So we don't know. We don't know what the value and what the tax collection is going to be each and every year. You know, I don't think we should be really impressed by the $6.5 million. look at what you're dealing with. The petroleum industry has billions. Now, they say they don't own the oil. They don't own the oil, but they certainly gain some revenues. They certainly gain tremendous revenues. If we looked at the value of the oil that goes through the pipeline, let's say it was $45 a barrel. Now, I'm not directing this to you people because this would be misinformation, but I want the commission and the state to recognize that I don't know if we should be impressed with the $6.5 million. If we valued the oil at $45 a barrel, at 435,000 barrels a day, they could pay taxes in 8 hours. So we shouldn't jump onto something because we're impressed with $6.5 $5 million in taxes. I mean, why don't we require TransCanada to post a bond or put up some money to assure us that, I mean, if we look at a spill of 50 barrels, you know, in a matter of 12 years, now that's not all going to be, I mean, what is the cost? Another thing we're going to have to examine, what is the cost of the cleanup of 50 barrels of oil? Nobody knows. Nobody knows who's going to pay for it, what's going to cost. But I just want to point out to the commission that I think through these proceedings, really take a good look at some of the promises. One, do we have anything in writing as to what they say? Yes, we will take care of everything. We will clean up everything. Every spill gets cleaned up. Where, I mean, do we know what really? Do we have anything in writing of that? And secondly, what are the costs that are faced by the state, the local fire department, or whoever has to be involved with, you know, some emergency or some problem along with the operation? I mean, they should be responsible for the operation of the pipeline, and the state should have some assurance that will be a firm commitment. I want to thank the commission for, you know, having these hearings, and coming to Clark so we don't have to run to Pier to everything, and we appreciate that. You know, you're taking the time to gather a lot of information here and listen to the local people.
I should note that the Pier Chamber of Commerce isn't very pleased with it, but, yeah, thanks. Mr. Kennecke, go ahead.
Commissioner, there were a number of contentions there that we would like to provide information on to the extent that we can. The first one, Mr. Piper, would be that it's written in state and federal law that TransCanada is responsible for the cleanup. That's where it's written. It's written in our state's code book and in federal law. So we'd be glad to provide you with citations to that. We'd rather be right than quick in communication with you on that. But that's where it's written. And as far as the rest of the questions, I'll pass the microphone around.
Well, is it the understanding of the commission that this is adequate, his comment that it's because it's in the law? You know, it's going to be taken care of.
Mr. Piper, I would just indicate that we're at the very beginning of this process,
okay.
And that's certainly something the commission staff and ultimately the commissioners will evaluate as part of this process.
Okay.
Thanks.
Can I ask, I mean, are you wanting us to get a commitment from them stating that they would follow state law?
Well, why not?
I'm just asking. Is that what you're after?
Well, I think it should go way beyond that. There should be a plan. Sure, the law says clean up, but what is your plan? What is your plan? How are you going to do it? What's the process? What procedures are you going to follow? Who's going to be involved? Who's going to have responsibilities? Whatever responsibilities the state or some local business or property owner, might be faced with.
You know, and I should just also mention, your organization has applied for party status, and so we will have an opportunity in a more formal process to evaluate these issues and try to find out exactly what the facts are based on the evidence that's submitted. So we may not get an answer to all the questions tonight, but we certainly will as we move forward.
Well, that's great, but I think it's, we start talking about these things now because there's a lot of things to happen between now and the time of your decision.
Sure, that's right. Let's go ahead and look to Mr. Kennecke. Did you guys have additional comments? Okay.
I'd like to address the spill frequency issue.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers that were provided in the risk assessment, I was trying to figure out how to explain it. The numbers were derived from a national database. It's based on historical data containing pipelines all across the U.S. for many years. When we derived the numbers, we calculated the number of spills we would expect based on the mileage of pipe.
Mm-hmm.
The way to think of this, it's not that TransCanada is expecting, you know, to spill anything, but if you were driving a car, your insurance company will have statistics, and they may say, you know, on average, you might expect to have 1.5 accidents per 10 years. And that's what these types of statistics are indicating. TransCanada's philosophy, as they've said, is to minimize or to have zero spills. So it's not an expectation. It's just based on historical data. It doesn't account for a lot of the pipes that are in that database don't have things like the FBE coating that we've talked about tonight. They don't have cathodic protection and other standards that this pipeline will be not only designed and manufactured to, but how it will be operated. So that's...
Well, we hope there aren't any leaks either, but yeah. there will be leaks. I mean, just like there will be car accidents.
And Mr. Piper, let's go ahead and allow TransCanada an opportunity to respond to your comments. And then if they say something that you want to make a comment to, we can certainly go back to you. Thanks. Go ahead.
The sensitive resources you mentioned, sensitive water bodies, things like James River, aquifers, things like that. There's a number of resources that have been identified by Department of Transportation in coordination with state and federal agencies and a lot of NGOs. Those areas are identified, and when the pipeline crosses those areas or a spill could potentially get to that area, we are actually held to a higher level of inspection and repair criteria than in other areas. So there is we recognize those sensitive areas, and there's a way to protect those. You mentioned the BTEX compounds, BTEX, the benzene, toluene, ethylene, methylbenzene, xylene. I went through them fast again.
You did. Thank you. Say them again, please.
Benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene. Those are soluble aromatic hydrocarbons that are contained within crude oil. The content in this crude oil tends to be very low compared to many other crude oils. If a spill did occur and it did get into water, then we would be required to remediate, clean up the water to federal and state standards, which we had talked about. And then I guess the last thing I'd like to kind of segue into your stuff is basically there is a plan in place that will allow Keystone to respond, detect, respond, contain, clean up, and that's all in the emergency response plan. And that's what Brian will talk about.
Thanks. And maybe just to state once again, certainly TransCanada's standard is that no leaks are acceptable. You know, you quote that the pipeline will leak, and, you know, I'm not here to say that with absolute certainty. Of course, I can't say that it will never leak. But this is where TransCanada has a comprehensive program in place to do really what all that can be done in that regard. So it starts with the prevention part of the program that involves the design of facilities and so on. Then it moves to the detection so that we have leak detection systems and those things. And then finally, if it does leak, we have our mitigation plans in place. We will have an emergency response plan in place for every basically foot of the pipeline right away. We will have basically a spill analysis that is very much a what-if scenario completed, so that we will determine in the event of a leak what volume will leak at every 100-foot spacing along the pipeline right away, and then we will develop the resources to deal with that spill. And ensure that they are in place and will be compliant with government regulations in terms of the response time to get to site and begin the cleanup and restoration activities. So it is very much a comprehensive plan that will be used. And those regulations, just for reference, are all in 49 CFR 194.
Mr. Kennecke, is the applicant done with the response? Okay, great. Any other comments?
Well, I you know, really appreciate, you know, the issues that they're looking at, but I still contend that, you know, we need a plan. We need to know a plan. We need to know the facts and details of some kind of a remedial plan. And who's involved? What is their capacity? What is their potential responsibilities? And what are some possible costs? I just think you know, we should need that. And
the document you're asking for makes a lot of sense. And so you know, presumably TransCanada can work with you either before the formal process or as part of it. Sure. 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 Well, and obviously they'll provide that information to us as well. If you want it in advance of, you know, and I know a lot's been introduced as part of the application. If something that is, you want it entered in the record that's not part of the application, we can certainly have that be a part of the process. Commissioner Colbeck.
Yes, just for my own clarification, maybe Kara, you can help me with this. He asked about the Raptor sheet, and I was thinking that was all backed up with written letters. Certified letters.
We did not receive a letter on that specific issue. However, as I read the federal laws and regulations, it's very clear that TransCanada had an obligation to protect those areas, and in turn, I believe we have an obligation to keep those portions of their application confidential. And certainly, as a party now, your organization could enter into a confidentiality agreement with the applicant. So you could, see them, as could any party that's intervened in this.
So you can get those documents if you want them.
Well, I'm a little confused. Where are the documents, and you know, how does one get them? And I mean, we're not, you know, I'm not looking for them just for my use, but for the public information. They should be posted on your website so that anybody could get access to it.
May I just ask a question here? Because I mean, I've looked at all that stuff because I have access to it, and I mean, it's my understanding. And again, it's very, looking at that enormous volume of stuff, it's sometimes hard to figure out exactly what is or isn't in the redacted portion. But based on my look at it, all that is redacted, the basic study and conclusions of the Raptor study, it's all open to the public. The only thing that is redacted are the precise locations of endangered species nests, and there's very few. And the reason the government or some portions of it don't want that is you've got people out there that will not use that information in the right way. You know, I think that's the reason, is they don't necessarily want people who might want eagle feathers or whatever to know exactly where eagles' nests are, although they probably know already. But the conclusions which basically get to, okay, if there are eagles' nests here, what kind of threat does that pose to the species? At least my recollection is that those are all public now. It's just the exact maps that contain the exact nesting locations and the verbal descriptions of exactly where those are that are confidential. That's it.
And more specific to our procedure at the commission, we have both the confidential version that contains no redactions that the commissioners and staff can view, and then the confidential redacted portion that's available to the public, and certainly it'll be considered in when appropriate in the commissioner's decision. And as far as the confidentiality agreement, parties are able to enter into individual agreements with the applicant, and it's brought before the commission, and It's part of the proceeding.
Ms. Enbach, maybe you could take Mr. Piper's information and make available him the letter that you filed with the commission last week, and then you can work to make sure that if you've got other concerns about information that we resolve all those to the extent possible.
As I recall, I checked the website yesterday, and there was one summary report on the Raptor report that was not available, in addition to all of the documentation that you, Mr. Smith, had alluded to. But there was one summary report also, I think, that was not available.
Again, I think maybe the best way to proceed at our commission meeting this morning, we did address this issue, and staff did file a summary of what is currently not completely open to the public, and so we'll get you a copy of that so we can make sure everybody's on the same page about what's available and what's not. Mr. Hone has been patient. I know he's got some comments. Unless anybody else has got something burning, I think you're up.
Mr. Chairman, I have a map here I want to show, and I'll just use a mic and walk if I can. Before I comment on that, this is a follow-up from something at the previous hearing. It's a new item. My name is Kurt Hone. I'm the web manager from Aberdeen, South Dakota, Kurt Hone, H-O-H-N. On the issue of the documents, Webb was one of the organizations that filed with the commission, asked you to have a special hearing to release documents that were filed by TransCanada on April 27th and all marked confidential, including the table of contents. I've never seen such a thing. I mean, it's like very odd. Now, I've heard from various people, not from these people, but from some of your staff, that that was a mistake, and that we're going to rectify that. But to rectify it, I was shocked when I learned that you couldn't get at the information, and I contacted John and a few others to figure out what I had to do to get it open. So that was April 27th. And you responded as quickly as you're allowed under the statutes, and there was a hearing held, which we attended, and you were all involved. An agreement was made that it was going to be released that Friday. And my understanding was what was released a week later. Now, maybe I misunderstood and I didn't look at the transcript to verify what was agreed to. As I understand it, and I've read Kara Van Bakken's letter, she sent, I believe it to us as one of the parties. Essentially what she's saying, if I read the letter correctly, is you have an email message from Jay Voigt, who I know very well, with SHPO, State Historic Preservation. And essentially he said in the memo that he didn't want the specific locations of the historic information released, but the summary, which is normally released on water systems, could be. All right? So we have that document. I've not seen anything from any federal agency, from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, from the Game, Fish and Parks, in writing, that says, from an agency person not connected with these consultants and this client, saying we do not want this released. In fact, since your hearing, I've received calls from two people, one with the Game, Fish and Parks and one with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, saying we can't understand why that's not released, and it isn't us that's restricting it, it's them, the applicant. Now, if your staff is here, truly here, to assist the citizens of South Dakota to get at this information, her letter says she talked to people and that the federal agencies, she had some federal statute or something that said it had to be blocked. The federal people say it doesn't. It's being blocked because of the client, the applicant. Now, the question is, how important is what's not being made available? I have no idea. Like I told you at the hearing on the 12th, won't know till I see it. But there's just a fundamental issue. It should all be open. It should never have been marked confidential in the first place. With all respect to Mr. Jones, if I were one of the CEOs involved in this application, I'd find out who filed that confidentially, and I'd get a new person. Because that was a bonehead mistake. I mean, it's foolish. How can you come to this state and say in good conscience, we're open, we want to be honest, we're going to work with you, and the first thing you do is block everything about your application? That's not how we do it here. Now, if it was an honest mistake, lift it. And don't use Homeland Security. My goodness, Homeland Security is getting blamed for everything. There's not a lot of Arabs out here in the Midwest looking for oil lines. If they came, we'd probably be able to notice them, and we'd call you. What's happening here is restricting information, and I really think the commission needs to bore down on that, because if you cannot submit letters from federal agencies saying, do not release this or that item, there should only be a handful of things that can't be released. But if you can't submit it, I submit, as a representative of one of the parties, that agreement that was made in your hearing on the 12th is not being kept. Now, we're going to get at those documents, so don't destroy any. Don't lose any, because we'll go to court through discovery if we have to get them. And this gentleman's smiling. He finds it very funny. I don't find it funny. You need to tell us what you're going to do, and you have an obligation to tell us and show us. And you know, if you do that, you'd probably have less trouble. Open disclosure, full disclosure, that's what we'd like to see. I have better things to do than go to peer and try to get you to do what you should have done in the first place. Not a question, comment. Now, with regard to water quality, I have a map, which I'd like to have, maybe Mr. Piper would hand this to the commission. It's the map from the wall. I've already given a copy to one of the TransCanada people, and I'll give it two of them here to this gentleman. They say they're aware of it, and if they are, then this won't be a big issue. This is a map prepared by the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. It's very hard to read. If you need bifocals like I do, you're going to need glasses. This is an enlarged map, which you can get from the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, and I'll give it to your staff so you can see it, make it much easier to read. There's copies here I'll just hand out to those in the audience who might want to look at it. This is a map of Clark County, and there's a legend on the right. And essentially, the light gray and the dark gray are shallow aquifer areas. This says the depth would be about 50 feet, and this would be about 50 to 100 feet from the land surface. You'll notice that along the west side of Clark County is a light gray and dark gray area. The little dot you see in between 117 and 116 north is Raymond. The pipeline, we plotted the pipeline on this map based on the last map we were able to get our hands on from your website. Now, whether it's exactly right or not, I don't know because I haven't seen all the documents, haven't had a chance to look at them. But it's essentially that light gray area and dark gray. I'd say about two-thirds of that edge of the county. Their pipeline parallels that side of the county. Now, one of the earlier hearings, these people said, we routed the pipe to try to avoid underground aquifers. This is shallow aquifer. It's used by farmers who live there. Our laws say that they have to prove that they will not impact the environment or the health and welfare of the people that live in this area. How do you prove that you won't leak in about a 40-mile area over an aquifer that's relied on by farmers in small towns? And there are people that were here tonight from Carpenter that can tell you they have water at 20 to 30 and 40 feet, good water. That's why I and the Clark Rural Water haven't been able to sell water to them. They have a source of water. That source of water has a value. We're not talking about land. We're talking about a resource under that land that has value that could be contaminated if they have a spill. Now, they say we're going to fix a leak. Think about that. A pipeline under pressure, 1,700 pounds, and it leaks. There's going to be a lot of oil. It will not be hard to see something like 200,000 gallons of oil. That'll be a major spill. BP had a similar spill in Alaska, covered almost a section of land when you've got all done with the contamination. But the contamination of the groundwater is even harder to track, because when those chemicals, benzene and toluene and all the things we were discussing earlier, get in the water, they're going to move. And to say you're going to take them out and completely remove them, I hope they're not saying that, because you can't do it. It's not possible. All right. The law says they have to prove. The burden of proof is on them that they will not endanger the environment or the water quality. There are several maps like this in other counties, and when we get to Marshall County tomorrow, I'll show you that one. You have access to the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. I think it would behoove the commission, independent of these consultants, because they work for him. They don't work for us. They don't work for you. Independent of these consultants, you need to examine that very closely. Because when you talk to a landowner and say, well, what's the land worth? That water underneath it might be worth as much as the land or more if you damage it. And I submit that they're going to have a hard time proving beyond a reasonable doubt that they won't contaminate it. Now, we talk about fixing a leak. Nobody's ever showed you pictures of how they fix an oil leak. Think about that. What are you going to do, weld it? Going to put a rubber boot around it? Turn it back up to 1,700 pounds of pressure? My crew fixed 200 and 160 PSI pipe, and I can tell you that's hard to control. Do they take the whole main line down? We need to see some specifics. Show us how you actually fix that pipe. I want to see pictures. I'd like to see drawings. If we build an extension to our water system, or if Clark Rural Water adds on, we have to take our blueprints to DNRD and have it approved and stamped. Where are the plans for this project? Where are the blueprints? Where are the engineering reports? Who's going to review those? I want to see them. And I'll be asking for them as part of discovery. Because when I build a water line that, if it fails, can't hurt anybody, except maybe flood the corn and cause crop damage, the state of South Dakota requires that I submit plans and that they be approved. It usually takes 6 months to a year on a major project. If a farmer in this room or a Hutterite colony builds a turkey barn or a feedlot, we require, DNRD and the state requires, detailed plans to be submitted and approved. And I will expect, and I think everybody in the state will expect, that the state give the same amount of due diligence to this project as you would one lowly feedlot in Marshall County or a turkey barn in Beetle County. Otherwise, the state of South Dakota is not doing due diligence. And as far as saying, well, how are we going to do it? We're going to rely solely on them to tell us what's going to happen. We don't have to. We had a spill in the Sioux Falls area, the Michaels pipeline, or the Williams pipeline. What happened? What do we wish would have been in place before that happened? And what happened? How did we turn out after it was all over? You learn from your mistakes or you learn from the past. Instead of listen to these people, that's fine. But I think we also need to look to some independent parties like the U.S. Geological Survey, which will give you far different numbers and statistics than this young lady gave us. They see a whole lot more leaks, larger. And, you know, the National Transportation Safety Board investigates every major pipe failure, and that's available on the web. Try reading about three or four of them. 83 pages long, well-written, well-documented, independent people. That's where I'm getting my information. And why is it? Because I can't get the information we should be able to get open and honestly from this oil company. The last thing I want to say, we banner these chemicals around. Benzene. This came from the Canadian Occupational Health Organization. That's not the title, but that's who they are. Benzene. Exposure can cause anemia or decrease in blood platelets and may result in increased risk of cancer. Toluene. An excess of EPA standards can cause problems with the nervous system, kidneys, and liver. Ethylbenzene can cause problems with liver, kidneys. Xylene can cause damage to the nervous system. We're not talking about some small thing. And so if there is a leak, it's one thing to clean up the oil and stop the leak. What do you do for a farmer who lives here and his family's drinking water out of an aquifer and they've been drinking out of it since statehood? What do you do for them? And what is this company going to do? They're going to do the least possible. They talk about the federal laws. In 2000, a pipe explosion at Carlsbad, New Mexico, killed 12 people. And ever since then, Congress has been trying to pass laws to tighten federal laws regarding oil and gas. You know what happened? You won't be surprised. The legislation was gutted and killed. And where am I getting that information? From the sponsor. You know how it was killed? The oil lobby. So I'm sorry if I'm a bit skeptical. And you know, they can question where the veracity of my information, and I'm giving you what I can find because they're resisting making a lot of what they have available. But I challenge the veracity of some of these slick blue papers that they're handing out as well, because they're underestimating the negative and overestimating the positive. We need to be realistic. What really can happen? What will you do, and how long does it take? And don't blow smoke. We deal with leaks in our water system. I can tell you how long it takes to mobilize a crew from Aberdeen and get them to Webster in the middle of the winter at 1 in the morning. It takes a long time. And if this Mr. Jones's people are coming out of Omaha, Nebraska, and there's a leak at Raymond, we got a problem. It's going to be a lot longer. We need people stationed in this state. We need people that can respond to a leak. We can't rely on our local fire departments, and we shouldn't ask them to fight this kind of problem and deal with it. They're not getting paid to do that. And there's a liability associated with it. That has to be nailed down in the condition of this permit in fairness to the people that you're trying to protect and the resources you're trying to protect. It has to be in writing. And don't let them tell you it's all covered under federal law, because all you have to do is call your colleagues in the other PUCs around the state and they'll tell you over a drink or a cup of coffee, it's a tough business. We're getting into something we don't know anything about. We have gas lines, and if a gas line leaks, it goes up. And if you're unlucky and you're smoking near it, you go with it. We've never had that happen. If you have an oil leak, it's going into the ground, and it's not going to be easy to get it out. And so I appreciate, too, the hearings and the commission's willingness to sit and listen at all these hearings and listen to me more than once, which is appreciated. But we're dealing with a very serious thing. I've spent most of my career working in this area. I'm not ready to just turn it over to somebody who's moving in from out of state and say, I'm going to trust you. I deal with contractors. It's arm's length, and you got to be careful, and you got to make sure they do what you expect they're going to do. And the only way I've ever found out that it worked is to have it in writing and have somebody at the state level have their hands on the reins. And I think you have the power and authority to put conditions on this permit. And you're hearing from people up and down the state, which gives you some idea of the concerns. I hope you have resources, funds available to hire your own experts, to look beyond me and these people and anybody else and be able to get somebody who could help you put this together. Because if you do it right, we could turn out fine. But if we just sit back and say, well, let them do what they want, the law doesn't allow us to get proactive or progressive, I think this could be a debacle. So thank you very much, and I'm going to leave this with Karen John.
Thanks very much, Mr. Holm. Other comments or questions? Hold on. I probably should have looked at the applicant to see if they had any comments. Okay. Ms. Anderson, did you have a question? Actually, we'd like you to use the microphone because our recording equipment doesn't pick you up if you're not speaking into the mic. Thanks.
My name is Lillian Anderson. Mike.
Mike's on.
All right, I'm Lillian Anderson. I'm from Langford, South Dakota. The news constantly says that the United States refineries are running at full capacity. This project is going to bring in 435,000 barrels of crude. Enbridge wants to bring in 410,000 barrels. That's 845,000 barrels extra of crude. So if the refineries are already running at full capacity, how are you going to refine another 485,000 barrels per day? Another question. Do we really need this crude oil? When you read about it in Canada, Canada does not want it coming down here. Canada is fighting it coming down here. Canada is very angry that it's coming down here. Canada wants the jobs. Canada wants it kept up there, and they want to refine it. So why are we accepting crude oil that can damage us to this degree?
I'm sorry. Canada doesn't want it, and then I didn't
Canada
hear.
Does not want the crude being shipped down here. They want to refine it up there. They do not want to lose the jobs to the United States.
Okay.
They're fighting with their labor unions. They're fighting it up there.
Yep. And then what was the last part of your question? I didn't hear that. Well, that was it. I'm sorry.
Mr. Jones.
Thank you. Be pleased to answer those questions. With regards to crude oil shipments into the United States, I think we hear on the news every day we've got a significant reliance on foreign sources of oil, and whether it be in the Middle East or Venezuela. And there's no question that the U.S. is looking to convert the reliance on foreign sources of oil to much more stable production basins such as Canada. So there's no doubt there is a displacement with regards to importations of foreign oil and offshore oil. The other one is decline in the basins. The U.S. Basins, whether they be the basins in Oklahoma or Texas, are declining at about a rate of 5% a year. So the U.S. is going to continue to rely on importations, whether they be from Canada or Mexico or Saudi Arabia or where else. So there's always going to be a continuing need with this decline in production here in the United States. Oh, the question with regards to Canada doesn't want the oil down here. There's no question that there is a group in Canada, the labor unions, who are part of the refinery association, have intervened in the NEB application. This is the equivalent process, a federal process we have in Canada. What they would like us to do, of course, not us, the industry, they would like to see Canada change energy policy. Well, of course, debates on energy policy happen in our country as much as they happen in your country. So, we have these debates, and they're healthy debates. The premise would be that a refinery should be built in Canada. Well, if a refinery was built in Canada, then the products of that refinery would have to move to market. And so that's why refineries are near population centers. If you look in the U.S., most refineries are adjacent to huge, large population centers. In Texas, of course, is where most of them are. There's quite a few in Chicago, and that's because those are a large population centers, and they work in a hub and spoke basis. And so the products from those refineries can get to closest. It's the most efficient way to move those products around. So if we were to have a large refinery in Canada, and by the way, we have sufficient refining capacity in Canada, then we'd have to have a number of those products come through. The U.S. anyways. They would come through either products pipelines, or they'd have to move the coke for the asphalt or whatever. So the most efficient way is to build a crude oil pipeline to feed these refineries. And the number one reason really is to change the source of oil from foreign offshore to domestic or North American based. I apologize for the long-winded answer. Obviously, I have a lot of passion for my business.
Thank you very much. Other comments or questions? Seeing none, we would thank everybody for your patience and sticking around tonight, and thank you for all of the great questions and comments. Thanks.